This is Judy Kwan. Today is August 8th, 2013. I'm here with Miss Peggy Saika at APIP. She's the Executive Director and President of APIP. I'm here at the APIP office in San Francisco, California for the Asian American Reproductive Justice Oral History Project. Okay, so we can get started.
Thank you.
Let's start with wherever you want to start, whether it be how you grew up, where you were born, but I really want to focus on how you developed your political consciousness.
So I get asked that a lot, and I think that, so I normally respond by saying that, you know, I'm a third generation Japanese American, and so because my grandparents and my parents and my uncles and aunts and, well, everybody, you know, that I certainly think of as my extended family and all, they were all interned during World War II. And so I think because I, as I was growing up, you know, my mother and father talked about it like camp, you know, like I never realized it was a concentration camp. But I think during high school, you know, as you're really developing so much more consciousness about different things, I really, it just has been, become, it became such a huge, just part of understanding my own genealogy and history and that what happened to Japanese Americans so easily could happen to other communities in times of crisis. And so, you know, I think that as I got older too, you know, just understanding how that's kind of the thread in many ways for me about being active to be able to not just find my voice, but to know that, you know, if you really believe that it's still possible to have a multiracial, multicultural democracy, and that this is our country, that you have to be able to participate and make sure that we're fighting for that, protecting it, and making it a better society for all of us, right? So for me, that coupled with just the consciousness around what it means to be an Asian American woman, a woman of color, you know, over time has just been, I think, my deepest source of both personal growth and inspiration, and just this incredible space for me to continue to try to be the best of who I can be, you know. And so, you know, it's evolved. You know, I'm at this place in my life where there's actually more looking backwards and saying, wow, you know, what's this one life been about? And so my sense of some core issues that reflect the most egregious parts of patriarchy, but also, you know, what binds us together as women, but also really binds us together in many other ways, is every day, you know, really resonates with me. So I think it's the source of great peace and revelation, but also fire in my belly.
What kind of community did you grow up in? Did you grow up in a largely like Asian neighborhood?
So I grew up in Sacramento, California. And I always say, you know, I didn't know it was a ghetto until people tell you later. And then there was urban renewal and all that wiped all of it out. So, but I grew up in a Japanese American community, community that was built post, you know, World War II, but where all of a lot of the communities that had left, you know, that so my grandparents and everybody that had been incarcerated, and then they came back, and so that's where I grew up. And but it was a community that, even though very at its core Japanese American, it was it really included a lot of other communities too. So I have a very strong sense of place, mm-hmm. and growing up in that way, you know. And I just think it is really informed, keeps informing why I think the way I do, and why I feel obligated and responsible in the ways that I do, but also a sense of groundedness and connection that's very deep for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you first get involved with the Asian American community as, you know, an organizer or some mm-hmm. kind of like advocacy leader?
Yeah, so I was growing up, and then I had, I had a really interesting collegiate kind of experience. But anyway,
tell me about the collegiate experience.
It's almost like, you know, I'm part of that generation where, you know, you really kept asking yourself, what are we doing in college, right? You know,
did you go to college in the 60s?
Yeah, in the 60s, yeah.
Oh,
in 70s,
wow.
Yeah. Late 60s, early 70s. So to me, it was a period too where you're really thinking about being engaged in a totally different way. So I was in social work school at Sac State to get a graduate program, and it was at a time where they were really developing organizers and, you know, community consciousness much more embedded in those kinds of programs. So, you know, Ann Arbor or Stony Brook, there were a lot of different places across the country where there was just a lot of activism connected to certain kinds of programs on campus. And it was also, you know, just at the time when Asian American Studies was really, you know, developing, you know, late 60s, early 70s and all that. So I got involved in the, starting to be a part of a group that started the first Asian American organization there. And at that point, and then it became, you know, a larger group there. But it was a time where there wasn't anything, you know, when you think about it, you know, there weren't elderly senior programs for our seniors, you know, so there were, Asian seniors that went to the city council and demanded, you know, programs, right, be provided for them, and, you know, so it was a time of incredible, especially during the early 70s, you know, time of incredible creativity mm-hmm. and activism. And so there I was as a community organizer, right, in Sacramento. And then, I moved to New York in 1978. Mm-hmm. But right the year before that, I gotten involved in the Free Chosu Lee mm-hmm. movement, and it was really through that when I did move to New York, then I got involved in organizing the New York Chosu Lee Committee.
Oh, okay.
And then at the same time, I joined the Organization of Asian Women, you know, and I worked in a community health center, but which was a small collective. That doesn't exist anymore, but you know, it was really great to be with other Asian American women that were very, very active. And in fact, I think we put together the first show or production, and it was really looking at the intersection of patriarchy and Confucianism. And how it's impacted, you know, Asian American women.
Yeah.
So it was really great. And so, you know, that, and you know, and the years that we were there, 6 years that we were there, you know, it was really an amazing time of being able to organize in the community, but also be connected to new things that were emerging, you know, there were things that, you know, unorganized workers were, you know, creating new entities there, and the you know, and annually there's the with the Women's Day, you know, then there would be a big march and all of these things that would happen associated, you know, with that day. But you know, this, we organized the first, like the third role women to celebrate International Working Women's Day, and it's just really amazing time to be able to do things like that with, you know, women from the from Harlem and you know, the Puerto Rican community, and it's just really amazing time of both growth and knowing that there was this continual thread that no matter, even if you didn't work explicitly for a women's organization or for like an issue that's, you know, seen quote unquote as a women's issue or whatever, like, you know, DV or whatever, that you would still, you know, you would be motivated to get involved in a lot of different issues and ways in which you really put together race and gender, you know, and so it was really great.
Yeah,
really wonderful.
Had that been the first organization that you've been involved with that was kind of addressing both, or like an intersection of your identities?
Yes, definitely, it was the combination, I think, of the Organization of Asian Women, and through that, the, you know, the Third World Women's Committee stuff, and then working in a community health center, you know, the Chosu Lee Committee, went to Cuba, you know, on a health study tour, you know, with the Antonio Maceo Brigade, and so there was just a lot of things going on. I became a mom.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's a big deal.
It was a very big deal. of a daughter. Yeah. It was amazing time.
Was organizing in New York a little bit different than the West Coast? In terms of like constituency, it was definitely different.
Yeah, you know, when I first moved to New York, Asian American really meant Chinese, you know, in Chinatown, you know, basically. Okay. And even though, you know, in Brooklyn and Queens there were huge swaths to the community. And then it was gradually like shifting, you know, it was a timing thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was mainly because of demographics, I would say, and scale of communities. But that just quickly was really changing even the years that, you know, I was there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Then,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so then we moved back to California in 1983, and I went to work for the Asian Law Caucus.
Oh, yeah. You were executive director there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What made you kind of work in an Asian Law Caucus? Do you have a background in law?
No, funny. I don't. Well, they had asked me, you know, if I was interested to come and work for the Asian Law Caucus, mm-hmm. and I had been, you know, they had, I think they started in 1972. They were really doing just cutting edge work. You know, they weren't just lawyers, but they were doing, they were, as they said, you know, facilitating organizing.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it was legal representation, but also doing community education and working on organizing tenants and workers and, you know, and working on issues around, you know, immigrant rights and all that. So it was an amazing opportunity for me.
Mm-hmm.
So my partner went to work for Asian Health Services, and then I went to work for the Asian Law Caucus.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long did you stay there for?
9 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What do you think you contribute to the organization, or what kind of vision did you bring, especially with your, you know, background in organizing in New York and mm-hmm. things like that?
I think I brought, I would say being a woman was huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's such a big part of who I am. I think an understanding that, you know, the issues around gender and sexuality really has to cut across any of your the work that you're doing, any and all of the work that you're doing, it shouldn't be ghettoized into like a women's project,
right?
Which is kind of the norm at that point. It really was the norm. And so I think that that was like a perspective. The fact that I wasn't an attorney, we really had, I learned in the deepest way what shared leadership really meant, and that you could be an executive director but not be hierarchical. Mm-hmm. You know, that we had such content experts, you know, all of the attorneys and other folks that were there, you know, that they were the ones that oftentimes not just testified, but they were at press conferences, you know, everybody represented the organization. One person is now the mayor of San Francisco, Ed Lee. And so, you know, day to day, I just learned what it really meant to have a title but not be bound by that title, that it was really for external purposes and for, you know, lots of different reasons that, you know, you might need it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't have to reflect a hierarchical or a way in which you build an organization that's actually just seen through or it's done through kind of the vision and the leadership of one person. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing, you know, while I was there, we recruited Dorina Wong, who became a Korematsu fellow there, you know, and she's an incredible lesbian leader. Mm-hmm. But to have her, game changer, mm-hmm. you know, to have the first kind of queer person come on, you know, staff, to have, you know, that I was able to participate on the organizing committee, board before the Asian Women's Shelter opened, but to be able to work on that for several years, to be able to, you know, really contribute towards the Asian Women's Shelter becoming, you know, the shelter itself and all that. You know, I just feel that I got to be who I am. And so, you know, imperfect and all of that, and learned a lot. And now when I look back, I think, oh, I wish I knew that, you know. Uh-huh. I'd been a far more effective director, but I just really learned so much, mm-hmm. you know, in this incredible time.
Mm-hmm. I had actually interviewed Becky Masaki, and she uh-huh. mentioned that you were part of the organizing group. Uh-huh. What kind of experience did you bring on to the Asian Women's Shelter Organizing Committee?
That's such a good question. What did I bring? I think, you know, I'm not sure that I could be that concrete, except that, you know, I brought my head and my heart, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just really, I felt so passionate about it. I really understood that, you know, the in one way you could think about a women's shelter as just a service, you know, that you provide. Mm-hmm. But when you know that when you create shelters, it literally saves lives. Mm-hmm. That when women and children are abused, it's the most egregious form of violence, you know, and that there's no excuse for it ever. Mm-hmm. And a shelter really represents a space, mm-hmm. That we take action, but we're able to be who we should all be, mm-hmm. right? Kind and generous and loving and nurturing and generous, you know? And to me, I think I've gained so much more than what I think I could have given, mm-hmm. really and truly. I think it's, the question is more, what did I gain from that, really, you know? Mm-hmm. And to this day, I far, far more, mm-hmm. than I feel, you know, I've ever given. But it's just really, just this amazing experience where you get to not just talk about something, but really work on it.
Yeah.
You know, and not just wonder, not just, there's nothing abstract about it, right? So what an honor for me, you know.
I mean, was one of the first, was it one of the first organizations that you found? Because I know you had a stream, like a stream of organizations that you were a founder of too.
Yeah, you know, I don't even remember. Well, at the caucus, it was, you know, with Mary Luke, you know, Pacific Islanders for Choice, and I don't remember that. You know, I don't think about it like that anyway, because you just like working with people or, you know, whatever, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, then do you want to talk a little bit about the founding of APIC and how that came about as well?
Yeah, you know, Mary Luke calls me and...
How did you know Mary Luke from afar?
You know, I'm trying to think. We all kind of know each other, right? and it's, I think, because we are very blessed to be a part of both a generation, but a network of women and men, you know, that have really, our values have shaped and created connections and whatever. So I can't even remember, you know, how Mary and I knew. Maybe she'll tell you how. But I know that we did.
Okay.
And when she called, it was just what an incredible, incredible opportunity, you know, to create an explicit API voice in the whole movement. Because there's one way you can look at it and you could critique that it's a narrow issue and choice, you know, really for a lot of the women's formations, they, you know, there's just so single issue and it's dominant. It's just been a policy, legislative kind of, you know, issue. And so very divisive, you know, some of the most stringent voices are part of that. And then I could understand that. I could join that chorus. The other side of it for me is, but I also look at it as, thank God, people, women, stood up and created that voice and the architecture and the perspective of building power, you know, owning an issue in that way. It's, you know, it's kind of like I look at it in the way that it was framed and organized and established. You have to kind of put it into its historic context of when that was.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you know, we can reflect, you know, right? Hindsight, 2020 vision, we could look and say, oh, why do people do that? And but I feel blessed that, you know, it was done. And so, you know, and I think we're living with both sides of the legacy of that, but then I think the question as activists always becomes, okay, so what do we do about this now, right? Yeah. So so Mary, you know, I just feel very, really lucky that she called, got me engaged. You know, the interesting thing though, one of the factoids at the time was that, which very, really resonated with me, that Asian American women at Berkeley were the highest. Really were the highest, or statistically, you know, had the most abortions.
In the country?
No, on the campus there. At UC Berkeley.
Oh.
No, of everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Of all women there.
Yeah, but the Asian American ones. Oh.
Not the Asian American ones.
Not the Asian American?
No, overall, they were getting abortions. The greatest number of abortions were Asian American women at UC Berkeley.
Wow.
That's what I said.
Huh.
Wow.
That's right.
But I could understand it. If you're in denial about being sexually active and you're using abortion as, you know, whatever, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I could see that. And then I could see on the other side, if you did get, you know, pregnant, even if you're not in denial about being that, you just didn't want to deal with it with your parents and all of that, right?
Right. Wow.
That was deep, though. So I just said, wow, you know, we've got to do something, right?
Yeah.
And organize ourselves, Yeah.
I heard that it started out from like breakfast meetings, like the small get-togethers. How did it eventually become the founding of an organization, like the official title?
I think what happened is that you do have these smaller huddles, and and it's very reflective of our leadership, because even though Mary Luke was nothing would have happened if she didn't initiate it and push it and all that, you know. But that being set aside, when it did become, you know, something, it's because we like to do that, where we're, you know, working together on something. And it has nothing to do with being passive or not, any of that, you know. I think it's reflective of both a style and a way of operating that is comfortable, you know. So for us, it's great, you know, you and I get together and let's do it,
yeah.
Right? But there's so few times, I mean, and we oftentimes we do this where we sit by ourselves, go, I think I'm going to do that. But starting organizations, that's really different, you know. And I think that where we see it now more and more with individuals, but by and large, I would say as a more normative state of how things evolve, you know. And so it was from these smaller huddles, and then, you know.
How long did you stay involved with the organization? Are you still, like, involved with Forward Together It Is Now?
I was a part of, Asian Pacific Islander, well, APIC, and then it became a peer. And I was really into all of us, Cindy, we were all involved in a peer for the longest time. And then it became
ACRJ,
and I wasn't involved. And I know Evelyn Shin and all that, but I think I, you know, and then, yeah, and then there, you know, it's really interesting, because we, you know, I haven't been that involved with the latest iteration of it, and I think it's, a lot of us got much more involved with NAPA, and choice was, you know, one of the issues, but it's a multi-issue. I think it was, NAPOF became a much more, I would say, for us, for me, I'll just speak for myself, for me, you know, a relevant vehicle, because it was multi-issues, national, how do you look at tracing the context of a broader set of issues that impact us. So, you know, that was, you know, I would say that was a part of it. I think that there were differences, individuals and personalities that I wasn't involved, you know, with ACRJ. So by the time it morphed from a peer to ACRJ, you know, I was really consumed with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network also. And we had our own, you know, the Laotian Organizing Project, and the girls and young women, you know, with Aya and all that. So we had a full plate. So I wasn't that, you know. And there were, you know, like I said, there are things going on with individuals, and, you know, just a difference in, you know, how people lead and all that. But, you know, that's very common, and, you know, you get over those things, I think. But a lot of it, to me, has to do with what keeps you connected, because organizations stay relevant on the ground in terms of being able to be a vehicle that more of us have traction with versus less. And so I think that's when I look back, I think that's more the evolution of it, you know. Because, and not get, you know, I always feel like, how do we not get stuck but move on?
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have to let things go and let people lead in the way that they see fit and their vision and all that, you know, and that we can't be involved in, like, every organization or every vehicle that's created, but then we have to make choices ourselves around where we think we could contribute and, you know, take responsibility and all that. So, Yeah.
Yeah, I know that a peer, yeah, I think it was called a peer, had that tension with Nahu and mm-hmm. the founding of Nahu.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that and perhaps like a peer's relationship with Nahu? I just haven't found anybody that can really speak to Nahu because no one really knows about it.
I know, they're gone now, I heard.
Yeah.
I just heard that.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting because Nahu was primarily created when Mary Chung left a peer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, you know, it really revolves around an individual leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you could get really subjective about it and have an opinion about this or that, but I do think that it's, if you just fast forward and look at where things are at now, you know, Evelyn Chen and, you know, her folks are really, you know, leading ACR, you know, the forward together.
Yeah.
And Nahu is no longer. Mm-hmm. So it, in some ways, you know, we just have to think about where it belongs for the historical record.
Mm-hmm.
But not get too bogged down in like what caused that or whatever, because even though it's kind of fun if you go out to dinner and talk about it, right? But in terms of like when I think about like lessons for the future,
mm-hmm.
you know, I always think it's about accountability
mm-hmm.
and individual leadership and what we all need to do to learn from experiences when things don't go as well as they could have.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the key lesson so we don't repeat that?
Mm-hmm.
And how important it is for each of us to be able to speak out, you know, not to be divisive, but when it's, you know, issues around integrity and, you know, respect and the things that, the values
mm-hmm.
that we want ingrained in whatever we're trying to build, right? And when those are absent, then how do we organize ourselves in a way that really reaches where we're problem solving together and that we resolve problems,
mm-hmm.
not get stuck or create new ones,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, I just feel that it's just something to learn from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be interesting if there was any ability for people to, or if that was like a specific, like something somebody wanted to write about,
uh-huh.
like, you know, what happened between, you know, like, not what happened in, like, you know, getting into the whatever, the muck, you know, about a peer, but organizationally,
mm-hmm.
maybe what happened, and then what are some lessons,
mm-hmm.
you know, would be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those, to me, are that would be a great thing,
mm-hmm.
right? With some degree of distance and an objectivity,
mm-hmm.
right? Then it contributes to the discourse
mm-hmm.
about our collective history, you know.
Yeah.
So, did you ever talk to Helen Zia?
No, I didn't get to. She never emailed me back.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Because she was on the Nahu board.
She was.
Yes.
Okay. Because I was debating whether or not to contact her again because I didn't really have like a good reason to contact her for Asian American Reproductive Justice. I
mm-hmm.
just wanted to meet her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, maybe she didn't think it was relevant, and so she didn't email me back. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, maybe I'll reach out to her again and see if she wants to talk about it.
Yeah, that would be really important. If you tell her that, you know, her name's come up and you
mm-hmm.
you know, talk to these people
mm-hmm.
and particular, you know, say you talked to me and I was,
yeah.
you know, mentioning Helen because
yeah.
she's an important voice.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How did you, so NAHU was a national organization, right? And, or
yeah.
it was the National Asian Women's Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And NAPOV also positioned itself as a national organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What kind of were the differences in types of leadership or organizationally between the two organizations?
Yeah, well, the one thing is that NAPOV is explicitly a membership organization.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually has a lot of, you know, I mean, they're not like this super multi-million dollar organization, so it depends on volunteers that just, you know, get really super excited
mm-hmm.
and even if it's for a few years at a time make a contribution and, you know, all that learn and grow and, you know, and then other people step in.
Yeah.
So that, to me, that grounding
mm-hmm.
has been incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
and that they're multi-issue. They are still, they were the first, and they're still the only multi-issue national women's organization, not just in the Asian community.
Women's organization.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I could be wrong now, but they were for the longest time. Yeah.
So the founding of MAPOF was actually spurred by the Beijing conference, right?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that and also how you secured funding from the MIS Foundation?
Well, it's really interesting because the International Women's Conference before Beijing was actually in Africa, Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered, you know, I had never gone to an International Women's Conference, but I remembered when they were organizing for Nairobi, there was just a tremendous amount of organizing around supporting African-American women going to Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
So the year or two before Beijing, there was just nothing about supporting.
Were you expecting something?
Well, I just felt like, wow, you know, so I talked to folks at Tani Takagi was at the Ms. Foundation, the VP of programs there, director of programs, and we talked, you know, about, and then they actually had their own delegation of 100 and something women that they were supporting to go to Beijing. So they asked me if I would lead the women's, the Asian API women, you know, there were like six or something.
Oh.
I'm like, yes. And then at the same time, Yin and I were working at APEN.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really thought that this was going to be so important, you know, had, you know, deep connections to environmental justice and the work that we were doing with women and girls, and so it was great. And so we actually, Yin and I, submitted an application to the UN office, the NGO office, in Washington D.C. to see if we could create, you know, she probably told you this story, to have a space in Beijing, because we had no idea who would be, how many API women were going to even be there, who would be there. So I thought, why don't we just have, you know, it was like just really to gather API women, you know, and to say, you know, what are our goals there, and, you know, what we're doing, all of that. So we submitted an application, and then we got a response that it was denied. And we said, oh. And then about a month before Beijing, we get a postcard that says, here's your room number for your workshop on API, Asian American and Pacific Islander women in Beijing. And we're like, oh. And so Yin and I are like, wow, this is happening. And they said, oh, it's going to, you know, it's listed already in the booklet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the booklet was this thick and all that. So that's how it happened. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, wow.
And I had received from the Gavodi Foundation a Gavodi Fellowship, and that just means, you know, they give you $5,000 to do some, like, individual leadership development. And I just called them and I said, you know, it'd be really great if I could divide this up. There's five Asian American women, you know, here, Yin and myself, and three board members of APEN, we could all go, right? So they said, well, it's up to you. We don't encourage it because it's really meant for you, but you could do whatever you want with it. So it paid for most of our, it was very cheap to go, obviously you could tell. And so we all went. It was great. And when we came back, also when we got together, there were, I think, 75 Asian American API women that came together, and we decided we'd get together again, and there were, you know, like, I don't know, over 100 or something. And then when we came back, we decided we should try to keep gathering or meeting. And the goal was how to bring Beijing home. And a year later, we founded MAPOF in Los Angeles with 120 or 25 women.
Wow.
I know.
There was a conference that launched that, right?
It was, well, we put it together. Uh-huh. It was kind of in order to launch, yeah.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. Isn't that great? So great. we're so lucky. Yeah. And I always think, well, the rest is history because they just went off and did, you know, and I see.
Oh, yeah, I have my sticker.
It's so great.
Yeah.
Do we have a chapter at Brown? Is that why?
No.
Yale, I think they have a chapter.
Yeah, Yale, they have one. Yeah. That's how I, like, found out about everything is Nepov. Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing at school. I was, you know, wandering, and I felt like school wasn't doing anything for me. And so I booked a flight to D.C. because they were having a summit conference. And I was like, you know what? Like, I care about this, and no one is teaching me anything relevant to this. I'm going to go learn it. And so I just, like, booked a flight for the next day, and I, like, went to D.C. by myself to, like, go to the summit. And
they have to. They have to interview you. You have to get recorded for their website. In their newsletter.
Oh.
That is so great. Oh my gosh. What a great story, right?
Well, it was really great because I went to the conference and it was, you know, youth and different chapters, and they had said chapter leaders, and that was the purpose of the gathering. And
oh
there I was, independent, just kind of like wandering. And I got to see Ajahn Mee Mwah, and like, Mee Mwah is a Brown grad, and so.
Oh my god.
She sponsored a Brown
Grad. She is a Brown, yeah, that's right.
She's from Minnesota, and so she was like, oh my goodness. And so she sponsored a trip down to D.C. for an immigration rally, and so mm-hmm. she paid for everything, and I got together, like, a group of 15 kids from Brown.
Oh my.
And we went down there.
Oh my god.
For a rally, and for some of them, you know, they had never gone to a rally before, or anything like that, so it was
God,
really,
what year was that?
It was just this past spring.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't know about the Asian American Women's Movement before then. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, that's why I have the sticker on there, because it actually means something.
Oh, gee, you know what? That when I, as soon as I saw that, when I walked in, I said, okay, really sense of your politics, liberty and nurture. So you support reunification.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your parents? Oh, we should turn this off because it makes you want to talk.